This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download at our website over at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about Iran, what went wrong with the Iranian revolution, and the sexual revolution that my guest says is underway right now in Iran. That guest is Janet Afari, a professor of Middle East Studies and Women's Studies at Purdue, though she'll be a fellow at UCLA. And she's the author of two previous books on the Iranian revolution. Her latest book, though, that we'll be talking about large part today is called Sexual Politics in Modern Iran. Janet Afari, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much.
Tell me a little bit about your own story. I understand you were born in Iran. Were you there for the revolution? Give me a sense.
I grew up in Iran, left a few months before the revolution. I went to Tehran University. That's where I did my undergraduate in literature and linguistics. Came to America with the idea of getting a PhD probably in English literature and then going back and teaching in Tehran. It so happened that the revolution happened at the time, so I had to make some rethinking. I got very interested in Middle East politics when I was in America, and in a way, in an attempt really to understand the revolution, because you know, I was at Tehran University in the 70s and was very much involved in student politics, and yet did not anticipate the revolution in the manner that it happened. So I spent a lot of years at University of Michigan, and then I became a fellow at the University of Chicago, where I spent a lot of years going through the archives and trying to figure out how this revolution came about. The result of which was my first book, The Iranian Constitutional Revolution, which basically said that this story started a century ago. And then the second one, which was called Foucault and the Iranian Revolution, which is basically, you could subtitle it, How the Left Got the Revolution So Wrong, and that included Michel Foucault. And this third one is, again, part of that same project. In a way, you could say I'm obsessed with the revolution and how it happened and why it happened. And this one looks at the sexual underpinnings of the revolution and also events since the revolution.
I'm speaking with Janet Afari. The personal choice you had when you were here before, and then the revolution started, the revolution quickly became reactionary. What choices did you wrestle with as to whether to go back or not?
Oh, it became very quickly clear for us that my family moved here, and so we ended up staying here. And of course, but then in the back of my mind, it was always a question of, you know, do I go back? Do I stay? Then I ended up marrying here. I have a daughter also who grew up in America. And then gradually, you know, your life sort of determines things for you. I was back in Tehran. The last time I was back was about 3 years ago. And have a number of friends at Tehran. I had a couple of lectures at Tehran University and at the Women's University, Al-Zahra University. And, you know, so I'm very, very active and involved in Iranian politics and with the Iranian community, intellectual community.
What was it like when you went back?
Oh, first, actually, it took me a couple of days to get the courage to go back to see where my old house was, maybe 3 days. I travel a lot to the Middle East, and there would be days when, for a split second, I wouldn't know where I was, because while I could read the signs on the wall, people look very different than the way they had looked in the 70s. The women in the veil and the hijab, which is called the official Islamic dress code. And, of course, the streets were a lot cleaner, actually, and parts of the city a lot greener. And I finally got the courage to go back to the neighborhood where we used to live, and everything was there. But, of course, the old car repair shop had turned into a health spa and, you know, things like that. Went in and knocked at the door. Oh, the house wasn't there. They had demolished it and built another one on top of it, though my father never sold the house. And I asked to go in, but then they wouldn't let me in. So a neighbor happened to recognize me. In fact, she thought it was my mother, and called me Mrs. Afari, thinking I'm my mother. So we went in, had coffee, and then she let me go to the rooftop, and then from there I looked around. And
Well, that must have been poignant.
It was very nice, yeah. It was very, very moving.
And did she have stories to tell about what had happened?
She did. She was actually an Armenian, Iranian woman, and she told me about, you know, before the revolution, religious minorities were always treated a little bit separately by the ordinary people. And she said that things really started changing after the revolution. That is, as the government and the state became more Islamist, ordinary people tried to avoid those distinctions. And she said Christmas is a really big deal at her house because everyone wants to get invited to her house. And it's no longer a case when where she goes to the fruit seller and she would touch something that they would be a little bit annoyed because, you know, here's a non-Muslim touching things. She said none of that is there anymore. And so the revolution has had this unintended consequence, if you will, because the public is so angry at the theocracy that they really now have a very different attitude towards the religious minorities. Of course, the number of religious minorities has also dropped.
And there was repression of religious minorities by the state, right?
There was a great deal of repression in the sense that they were treated as second-class citizens. They were, Baha'is have particularly been singled out, and converts to Christianity also, new converts to Christianity. But see, Armenians are considered old Christians and so that, and Jews also the same way. But they were, of course, a great number of repressions aimed at minorities, aimed at women, feminist activists, if you will, and aimed at leftists and nationalists.
Which was part of the irony of the failure of the revolution that we want to get to. Before we do that, I wanted to ask you, did you have trouble when you were giving lectures there? Were you free to lecture about anything you wanted?
I didn't have any trouble. It was the end of the Khatami era. President Khatami was still on, and it was at my old university, Tehran University. I was a little careful in terms of what I chose to speak on. I spoke on the Constitutional Revolution, but I chose not to speak about the role of clerics in it, which would have been very controversial. So I talked about the king and the nationalists and the parliament and things like that. But I sort of pushed it because I did talk about family issues and gender relations and human rights, and there were some gasps when I was speaking in the audience. It was funny because I was showing cartoons from about 100 years ago that you really can't show today because they're so open in terms of so critical of gender relations. Mm. But no, in that sense, I wasn't. And it was a very sophisticated audience at Al-Zahra Women's University. I was asked to give a talk, and it was sort of an impromptu thing. So I just gave a talk about gender historiography, how women's history has been written, if you will. And, you know, I put in a little bit about various schools of thinking, Marxism and critical theory, and also Michel Foucault, and sort of in the back of my mind thinking, you know, is this going to go through? And then at the end of a conversation, my talk, I had people getting up asking the most sophisticated questions, and obviously had understood everything and were a couple of stages even ahead of what I had assumed. It was a very nice experience.
I'm speaking with Janet Afari, a professor of Middle East Studies and Women's Studies at Purdue, who's written a couple books about the Iranian Revolution and has a third one coming out from Cambridge called Sexual Politics in Modern Iran. Before you left Iran, you said you were active in student politics. If that was radical politics or politics against the Shah's dictatorship?
No, mildly, very mildly. I was involved with some students in terms of doing basically social welfare types of things in the poor communities of Tehran. And even that was a little bit too much. I remember being approached by a member of the Savak, and we were doing absolutely nothing compared to what the radical students like the Fedayeen and the Mujahideen were doing. I mean, very, very minor things. Approached basically and told that these were, you know, off the chart and I shouldn't be involved in activities like this, and gave a warning. And I was told that there would not be a second warning.
I guess you take those warnings seriously.
I took it seriously, yes.
The student activists, the radical student activists who were trying to overthrow the Shah and succeeded with other forces, I'm sure they didn't expect what happened. And so why don't we talk about the failure of the revolution? I remember in reading your book that there was a poster that someone was holding at a protest. We made the revolution for freedom but got unfreedom, which says it just about in its entirety. And so how did they get unfreedom?
Oh, it's a very interesting question. You know, the narrative that the left created about 20th century Iran was that Iran was becoming very, very democratic. And then in 1953, there was a coup, American-sponsored and British and American-sponsored CIA coup, which overthrew the government of Mohammad Mossadegh, returned Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi to power. Now, that narrative is actually correct. It's not that it's incorrect, but it's only very incomplete. So the revolution was ostensibly a move against that coup that had installed the government of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, and it was aimed at supposedly a more modern and more democratic Iranian society. Except democracy really wasn't talked about within the left at the time. The issue was really anti-imperialism. The issue was really to overthrow, you know, a state that was backed by U.S. imperialism. The reason I said that narrative is only partial is because there was sort of another underlying reason for the revolution, which the left was very much unaware of, and that was the fact that Iranian society had dramatically transformed in terms of social relationships in the 20th century. To give you one example of some of the things I've been working on, in the early 20th century, an elite man would probably have three kinds of wives. He would have a formal wife, what's called a temporary wife, and he would also have slave concubines. And he would also be engaging in homosexual relationships, although they weren't called homosexual relationships. And he would probably have a boy concubine, and that would be an acceptable way of living. Of course, by the 1970s, that was entirely gone. The acceptable way of living was to have a monogamous heterosexual relationship. So that was just one example. Another one was that Iranian women at the beginning of the 20th century were urban Iranian women, that is, where, of course, their movement was severely restricted. There were no schools for them, or hardly any schools, let's say, for them. Certainly no clubs and social associations, right? And by the middle of it, by the 1970s, they're very active at the university, they're in politics, they're in government, and so forth. So in a way, if you will, there was a social contract in which the progressives had told the families, allow your daughters to come and become more educated, and we will promise you that they will remain dutiful wives and dutiful daughters and dutiful mothers. And for a while, that actually worked. Except then came the 60s and really came the 70s. The West was always a model where people looked at and, you know, Iranian women were more or less following the trajectory that European and American women had followed. But when the 70s came, the sexual revolution happened in the West, people were really taken aback in the whole of the Middle East, probably, I would say, not just Iran, in the sense that that was unacceptable to them, this idea of a sexual revolution, of a woman's sexual, if you will, according to them, promiscuity, of the recognition of a gay lifestyle, that these became entirely unacceptable ideas. So in the 70s, you really see, the early 70s, you really see this turn back by the public, but also by the left, completely rejecting the sexual revolution that's going on in the West. The revolution really is a result of all these factors. Therefore, it's a reaction to the 1953 coup very much. It's a reaction to imperialism, absolutely. It's a reaction to the Shah's autocracy very much. But it's also a reaction to the change in sexual mores of society.
And you called this, Janet Afari, you called this a revolt against secularization from above, which is kind of a nice phrase.
Yes, very much. Yeah, it's secularization from above because you didn't really have the environment where you could talk about these issues on television, on radio, in articles, in newspapers, extensively. I mean, there was talk. The National Organization for Women, which is a very progressive organization, was very much led by the Pahlavis, or at least it gave the impression that everything it did was dictated by the Pahlavi regime. Later on, I actually interviewed people who worked for the National Organization of Women. And they told me that so much of what they did was not dictated by the state. But at the time, the impression was that feminism is a project of the regime, that the regime is cramming down people's throats. And there was a real reaction to feminism, so that feminism completely became identified with the autocracy of the Pahlavi regime.
And that's ironic, since the leftists who tried to overthrow the regime, you would think in an American mind, would be championing feminism at the same time.
They were supporting feminism in the extent that they made, you know, remember the old left had the distinction between bourgeois rights and, you know, other working women's rights. I remember endless discussions in meetings about, well, were these rights that women were demanding, were they bourgeois rights or were they working class women's rights? And the fact is that, you know, that whole distinction was very arbitrary, of course. So they would support things like women's education and employment and better health care and particularly working women's conditions of life, improvement in that. But they were adamantly opposed to what we would call today sexual revolution. And within the left, there was this real hierarchy. In a sense, if you wanted to have a relationship, first of all, you weren't allowed to have a relationship. And if you did, it had to be secret. And then if you wanted to do that, you had to get permission. You were told to marry. So very quickly, leftist leadership assumed the role of the parents, you see, who had to give permission for marriages. People in the left actually had to get permission for getting married. And they were told that...
Permission from the left leaders.
Yes, permission from the left leaders. So there was this hiatus, this period, where in the Islamist organization, of course, the clerics were giving permission for this. And in the left, it was the leftist leaders who were giving permission with this.
Now, were many people within the left or the male left worried about this alliance with the clerics and Khomeini?
There were some who were worried about this. There were some of the followers of Mossadegh, a very great intellectual called Khalil Maliki, who very early on in the late 1950s and 1960s began to warn people about this alliance with the clerics. But most of the intellectuals on the left thought that this was just a strategic alliance. They assumed that the clerics were just too dumb. They wouldn't possibly be able to run a country. They need us. We're intellectuals. We're technocrats. We've gone to American universities and Western universities. We certainly are the ones who are going to be running the country. So let's use them to make the revolution. And once the revolution is made, of course, we'll take over.
They didn't realize they were the ones who were going to be
They didn't used. Realize they were the ones, right?
You know, Janet Afario was reading your book, Sexual Politics in Modern Iran, and I was struck at how sudden the repression happened after Khomeini came to power. Within 3 weeks, women weren't allowed to go to movies or movies with men, and I didn't realize it was that dramatic.
It happened very quickly, and you see, you have to ask yourself, why did it happen so quickly? It didn't happen so quickly because the regime was in a position of power that it would enforce it. It happened because a lot of people at the bazaar level, the low-level merchants, deeply felt and believed in those types of gender segregations. And so they were the ones who started implementing what Ayatollah Khomeini and others were saying.
There's a moment in your book where you suggest that maybe the clerics could have been curbed a little bit anyway, and that is March 1979, International Women's Day, and the protests that followed. There were thousands, maybe tens of thousands of women with some internet world feminists there. And yet, at some point, the rallies were called off. Who called them off and why?
Right. There were Simone de Beauvoir at the time wrote a very nice letter in support of Iranian women. Kate Millett came to Iran in support of Iranian women. The situation of Iranian women was front page in the New York Times and all other newspapers at the time. I would say that the moment was lost because people began to realize, in a way, 79 was probably the beginning of realization of what was happening. But I would say that two events determined the course of the revolution. The first one was the takeover of the American embassy in 1979. It was a very clever and shrewd move by supporters of Khomeini. Apparently, they took the initiative, and then Khomeini told them to stay on. In this way, Khomeini took away from the left its sort of anti-imperialist card, if you wish. I remember actually being in discussions with people about what this meant, and I remember my leftist friends saying, well, you know, this shows how anti-imperialist this government is, and therefore we should be supporting it. And of course, the second moment was a year later, was the war between Iran and Iraq, when Iran was attacked by Iraq, by, of course, in response to border provocations by Iran. Of course, the whole country became nationalist. And at that point, it was no longer important who was the leader. It was important to save the nation, if you will.
And so so any kind of leftist criticism would get to be viewed as anti-patriotic.
Precisely, as we've seen here in this country also.
Yes, that's a terrible phenomenon that happens
everywhere. It's a
terrible
phenomenon.
Now, you told me as we were coming in today that you, here in the United States, in Detroit, I believe, were at a meeting about a year after the revolution started, and you were kicked out of that meeting. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, God, it was funny. It was, just a year or so after the revolution, and I had translated some essays from English and French into from English and French into Persian. It was one of the first feminist publications we had on women and revolution. And so my purpose was to try to draw attention to the question of women's rights and women's rights issues. So I asked to go and present this at a meeting. I called to say that I'm a member of a group and would like to come and have a little presentation. The first question was, how many martyrs have you given to the revolution? And we said, I'm sorry, we haven't given any martyrs. We're a new group. We were formed after the revolution. They said, well, you don't have a right to speak. So we went to the conference anyway, and a lot of people spoke, and then I took the floor in the audience, and I don't have a voice that really carries. And so members of the audience said, go take the microphone, in the main microphone. So I got up and went to the main microphone and started talking. And as soon as I started talking about women's rights issues, they shut down the microphone army. And then they picked me up physically and kicked me out of the meeting.
No kidding.
It was a funny experience. A lot of people walked out, I remember, after that in support.
So much for dissent even here.
But what that showed was how unwilling the left was really to talk about women's rights issues.
Well, we're fast forwarding about, 16, 17, 18 years to today. And you insist in your book, Sexual Politics in Modern Iran, that there is an ongoing sexual revolution in Iran, which might surprise listeners who hear about repression of women in Iran and hear about the executing of gays in Iran. Tell me how you can argue that the sexual revolution still goes on.
Sure. Well, the government started, first, let me give you an example of here before I tell you what happened in Iran. In the United States or in the West, the birth control revolution was a very important revolution, as you know. And that, of course, led to change in sexual relationships inside marriage. Sex became important inside marriage. And then gradually, sex became important outside marriage. And then as that became important for heterosexual people, people began to recognize the importance of sex for gays, right? And so that's kind of the process that we've gone through in the West. In Iran, a similar process is happening in a very, very short time. The revolution began by the government putting aside the family protection plan of the Pahlavi era and demanding a pronatalist policy. So if you had 7 children, you'd be given a plot of land. They wanted more people for the war, more young people for the war also. Well, after a few years, by 87, it became clear that there was an absolute population explosion. The government had no means of supporting this type of a population. And so they decided to support a family planning program. So some of the people who had been involved in the family planning program in the Pahlavi era came back with the drawings, but they now presented it as an Islamic one. And it's very, very comprehensive. So, for example, birth control became free. Tubulation, vasectomy, all these are not provided by the state. There are mobile units that go to villages and perform all these services for the community. They have recruited about 50,000 women, ordinary women, mostly married women, given them training in family planning. Their job is to train the younger generation and teach them, how to control the number of children. They've also set up, as far as I know, the only one in the Middle East, a sex education campaign class. You're required to sign up for this class before you get married. There you're taught about birth control, and you're also taught about sex. So interestingly enough, a lot of young women are learning about forms of female sexual experiences, not quite in great detail, but the fact that it exists at least through these classes. All of this has had a great impact. on top of the fact that the economy is in bad shape and people are very discouraged with the whole idealistic utopian image of the Islamist State. So women themselves are very eager. This has been combined with literacy programs so that literacy rates are quite high in the 90s now for women. And as you know, probably the number of women who are going to the university is quite high. In fact, they had to set up a quota for men in the last year because something like 65% of college students were women, 35% were men. And so they have to arrange that. There's a quota set aside for, if you will, it's a quota for rural communities. Basically, it's a quota for people who participated in the war and their families. So all of these, plus the fact that, this is something Planned Parenthood can learn, by the way, which is that the same clinic that gives you pills also vaccinates your children. So there is no stigma about going to a clinic. It gets all done in one place, you see. All of this has meant that the birth rate has dropped dramatically from something like the average used to be each woman had about 6 or 7 children, and now the average is below 2. So it's actually quite remarkable. So that has meant that marriage, the institution of marriage is being redefined. Marriages are no longer strictly arranged. People are having a great say in marriage and who they want to marry. And now sex in marriage has also become very important, but sex outside marriage has also become important. In the urban communities, there's some degree of dating going on, quiet. So people go out, despite all these rules and regulations of Islamic State. They date for a year or two, and afterwards the guy comes to the girl's family and says, may I have your daughter in marriage? But in fact, they've made all the arrangements between them.
I'm speaking with Janet Afari. She's a professor of Middle East Studies and Women's Studies at Purdue. Her book is Sexual Politics in Modern Iran, her latest one. You dedicate this book to the 1 million signatures campaign, which is also called the Campaign for Equality. We have just a little more than a minute left, I think. Can you explain what that is?
Campaign for Equality is a campaign. It's a grassroots campaign by Iranian women started about 2 years ago to end unequal laws in marriage and divorce. Last example, the average age of marriage for girls today in Iran for women is 24, but the legal age of marriage is 13. So that tells you the whole story of how different the laws are versus what the reality of Iranian women's lives
the
are.
The legal age was 9 at one point,
you said. It used to be 9, and it was the campaigns of women led to its increase.
Now, I know Shireen Ebadi, the Nobel Prize winner, has been involved in this. And
very much. She's one of the instigators of the whole thing.
But some of the women have been arrested for participating in this.
They have been. And the government of Ahmadinejad has clamped down on them recently. And the government, in retaliation, has introduced its own law just recently called Family Protection Law. But it's a law that actually allows men to practice polygamy with great ease. And so this is almost an answer to the million signature campaign. But the movement is strong. It's grassroots. It's not just the urban women. It's rural women. It's all sectors of society. They go door to door. They're learning from all variety of Western and Middle Eastern movements. And basically their aim is to teach other women about the laws and about the importance of campaigning to reform them.
So there's a real dynamic tension in Iran right now.
Enormous. And you see, the whole thing with Bush administration wanting to attack Iran plays into the hand of the conservatives in Iran. They would love it if the United States would in some way provoke Iran, because then they can really clamp down on all the progressive forces.
Well, we sure hope that doesn't happen.
Let's
Janet Afari,
so.
Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.